shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The talk of the town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Daytime turns me off and I don't mean maybe. 9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound. When it's gone, I run out to see my baby. We get grooving when the sun goes down.
Welcome to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. And we're a little rusty, haven't been on for a couple weeks. We're going to talk in the next hour about Project Onward and some mashup rock and roll art from Los Angeles. And much of the first hour is going to be about mental health and the Chicago Police Department and the Chicago Fire Department. And joining us in studio, I'm glad you guys all came down, is Lieutenant Antoinette Ercitti, thank you, of the Chicago Police Department. And we have Alexa James, Executive Director of NAMI. And say what we'll get into NAMI, but say what NAMI is.
National Alliance on Mental Illness, Chicago chapter.
And our friend Frederick Nitsch, role player and Chicago artist.
Hello.
Thanks for coming down. So let's just start with what NAMI does and how you coordinated with and how you hooked up with the Chicago Police Department.
Sure. So NAMI Chicago is an organization that supports all people who are impacted by mental health conditions and substance use disorders. And really, our effort is to decrease stigma and reform the mental health system, which is a pretty big task considering we've never had a fully functional system. And one of the biggest actors in our system is, unfortunately, from a crisis perspective, right, but is the Chicago Police Department and all first responders. So we've had the privilege of working with the department for over 14 years on many things, but in particular the crisis intervention team training.
And what goes into that?
So hopefully Lieutenant will chime in on that too, but it's a 40-hour training. It's voluntary. It's for officers who want to gain a deeper perspective on how to support people who are experiencing their worst day of their life, a mental health crisis, and their families. And there's real skill set building that happens. So they have a very strong understanding at the end of the course about signs and symptoms of mental health issues, right? What may have looked criminal, now they have a better understanding. It is behavioral and is related to this illness and this disease. They spend a lot of time role-playing with individuals like Frederick, who's, we'll talk more about that later, and they learn the perspective of lived of people with lived experience, right, who touch the system. And also they review order, their general orders about how to support somebody in crisis, what rules to follow, how to utilize the department. But what's really unique about this program is it's a program. It's not just a training. It doesn't end at 40 hours. It expands well beyond and really becomes integral to our mental health system.
Lieutenant. Yeah, talk about what the role playing does. And actually, we were talking in the green room. I didn't know this kind of came to Chicago in 2004. So talk a little about the history. That's kind of recent history still. I mean, you got the idea and talk about Memphis, the roots in Memphis, then coming to Chicago.
Yes, the best practice model is known as the Memphis model, and it originated in 1988 after an incident that happened in 1987. My understanding of it is Memphis police officers were dispatched to a man experiencing suicidal thoughts and actions, was armed with a knife when the officers arrived. The situation escalated and that man was shot and killed. One of the results that came out of that unfortunate reaction in the community is that they all came together and formed what could be described as a task force. At the heart of that program for the Memphis Police Department was the National Alliance on Mental Illness, just like the chapter here in Chicago is at the heart of our program. A lot of mental health advocates and providers, universities there came together and tried to determine how they could best educate police officers on the signs and symptoms to have increased awareness and alternative responses to when they do encounter someone in crisis.
And it started in Chicago in 2004 then?
That's, yes, with support out of Springfield from the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board. Our program got on its own feet in 2004.
And when did you join the force? When did you join the police department?
I joined the police department in 2000.
So what was it like for you when you joined it? I mean, as far as this type of thing going on and mental health questions and issues of depression and stress and stuff, what was it like for you in 2000 and how things evolved over time?
Well, I think one of the positive things is that there's been an obvious increase in awareness of these types of events and how frequently they're happening. Myself, I received the 40-hour training in 2006. Again, I think it was advantageous that it was available so early in my career. And I think having that increased awareness gave me additional skills that aren't just limited to responding to a person in crisis, but, you know, that I was able to use in other areas of my career. And then again, I think that that's what's happening as this program has become a best practice model, that it's spread to at least 45 states, that there's more than 2,700 communities that are supporting their officers with this model.
What are some of the skills and some of the lessons you learned that you put into play and other officers put into play?
Well, I always say that, again, it's not that we maybe don't necessarily have these skills, but to really practice with subject matter experts and to dedicate this much time to it, but active listening, again, communication skills really at the heart of it, really understanding how tone and inflection can set the direction of an interaction. Really, I think one of the biggest changes in understanding that come with this program and this model is really slowing things down. Obviously, it's a very fast-paced career. There's a lot of events that require a police response. And really, with this program, we're really focused on taking our time and slowing things down and really building that rapport with the person in crisis. And building rapport with community members is, again, I think what's at the heart of what we're trying to do as police officers here in Chicago.
Boy, that's... building rapport with community members, that's yeah. Tough, right?
Well, and I think you know, it's important to notice that we are asking a lot of our first responders, right? That over time, de-investment in communities, especially in mental health and healthcare services, have put a lot of the energy on first responders to be mental health experts, right? And so, as Lieutenant Arcidi said, we're asking people to slow down. We're asking them to take their time. We're asking them to really utilize that critical thinking that, like, now I need to utilize a different skill set, right, in this interaction, which is a pretty significant resource drain. And so we just want to commend the department for stepping up in such a significant way and really over the past few years significantly investing in this program.
Frederick, what do you do as a role player with the group?
Sure. So I and my fellow role players come in on Thursdays. So that's after, you know, the majority of, you know, the 4-hour training has occurred. And we enact mental health crises. You know, between myself and my other role players, we cover, you know, the major diagnoses. We're in a room, and we enact things largely that have come from our own lives, from reality. And you know, we have sort of basic backstories for the scenarios that we ourselves have written. And officers come in usually groups of three. The entire encounter is videotaped. And the officers are then expected to assess the situation, you know, de-escalate us, you know, with the intention of getting us to agree to go with them to the hospital. You know, then on Friday mornings, all of us, all of the officers who've been involved that week, the sergeants involved, lieutenant, a representative from NAMI, and all the role players. We watch all the videos, and we debrief. We talk about what went well and what you know could have gone better and why.
We got to take a break, but how many people in the group? How big is the group?
It's usually, you know, five to seven people each time we do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break for some spots, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk more on mental health and the Chicago Police Department and the Fire Department and 911, right? Mm-hmm. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN, and we have Lieutenant Antoinette Ursetti of the Chicago Police Department, Alexa James, the Executive Director of NAMI, and Frederick Nitsch, a role player with NAMI, right?
Right. That's the way.
I'm glad you came down, Lieutenant. I mean, I've got like a couple friends who are cops, and I talk to cops at the Matchbox, where I go to for drinks, and they talk about, have you ever been to the Matchbox? And so, I mean, I hear a lot about stress. So, I mean, just to cut to, I mean, how stressful is a job for a Chicago police officer? And, you know, then when you came on 2000 and everything we're reading about in the news now, I mean, I can't get my head around how you guys handle stress.
Well, again, the nature of the work itself is we're emergency responders, so we are going to events on a regular basis where there's trauma that's happening. So one of the things that we've increasingly been learning about in our department is vicarious trauma, compassion fatigue, how responding to those events over time can take a toll personally, and it's been very helpful, I think, to have that reinforced and to understand that more.
I mean, I saw the mayor's comments this week about what he's not going to miss, you know, and you know, you're not going to be miss being around families, you know, would have to see their kids or no other parents show up, the lack of support system and stuff. It's the stress just has to be over the top. Do you want to?
I think we're seeing a city. I think we have a wonderful city. I think there's so much opportunity here. I think we're an escalated city. I think we're kind of a sick city sometimes, right? We see high levels of trauma. We don't necessarily have the resources or protective factors in place to mitigate the trauma. When we go out with Lieutenant Ursetti and her team to roll calls and talk to officers about compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma, I think it's this like awareness building that's important, right? We talk all the time about how they work hard to mitigate physical injury and physical risk because they have tools to do so and vests to wear. But what we don't do enough, a good job with them is equipping them with emotional mitigation, right? Like, this job is going to impact you. They're superheroes, but they still are impacted. What are we doing, you know, in partnership with the department or as a community to make sure that it doesn't make them sick and it doesn't make them so distressed that it interferes with their relationships?
Can you elaborate on what compassion fatigue is?
Sure. It's, you know, when you see trauma all the time, every day, and when you are tasked with managing that for other people, what we're asking you to use is a skill set with empathy, right? Which means I need to know how you feel right now. Maybe I've never been there, but it's a very vulnerable place to be if you're really doing it well. And it's the most productive way to get somebody to feel validated. But it's gutting if you don't replenish. And so we see that all the time. And if you don't have support around you, if you don't have a clear structure of expectations, you are very highly likely to develop compassion fatigue. Doctors, clinicians, nurses, you know, we see this a lot with emergency department doctors too. This is very common. It doesn't mean you're sick or weak. It doesn't mean you can't handle the job. It just means we have to pay attention a little bit more.
We were talking before we went on the air, it's in the news, 7 officer suicides since July for everybody. How hard is it for, anybody, I mean, not just, you know, just talk about their problems and to say I need help. How hard is that?
I think it's really hard.
Yeah.
I think it's really brave when people say I need help. I think that a lot of people don't know they're actually even suffering. What we ask people is be an ally. Look out for each other. You know, it's a silly example, but if I were at a Starbucks and I saw like a dad with a stroller struggling through the door, I'd open the door for him. I wouldn't think twice. We don't do that when we see people that are hurting. And we just need to be better about it with every profession and with everybody in our community.
Right, right. Frederick, what do you see in the role playing?
Yeah, I mean, if, you know, and just to go back to the simple idea of asking for help when we are really struggling. I mean, you know, I don't know if this was implied before, but, you know, the role players with NAMI and CIT are all people who are living with mental illness, right? So I do have a severe mental illness. I've been in the hospital 3 times. And, you know, when I was severely struggling, you know, when I had to drop out of graduate school in my early 20s, you know, the way that I did ask for help was from my family, and they helped me find a wraparound clinic up in Rogers Park, Trilogy Behavioral Healthcare. And, you know, Trilogy provides, you know, group therapy, individual therapy, psychiatry, you know, physicians as well. I mean, all under one roof. And something that has become so clear to me in the last couple of years is that had I not had the support of my community, my family, and a social worker on my side, making all of that access so easy to me, I would not have done well. I mean, I had all of that so easily accessible, and I was still barely treading water for 5 years. So I feel that people are asking for help more and more, but we need to know how to respond. And our response can't just be, oh, you should go see a shrink. I mean, right. That is not enough of a response. The response needs to be, you know, very giving, very, very loving.
Empathy is a key word.
Yeah.
I mean, empathy is a key. When you bring this up, do you bring this up in your role playing and stuff? And how do people respond if you bring it up, your own personal journey?
So it doesn't come up in the role playing. So I'll explain a little bit more what happens during the week. So on Tuesdays, part of the 40-hour training is hearing from a panel of family members of people who've had folks in their family struggle with mental illness, and a panel of folks who themselves have struggled with mental illness. Now, before I did the role plays, just to sort of get my feet wet, you know, experiencing what it's like to work with the police, I was on those individual panels. And in that context, I told my personal story. Because I do the role plays now, I no longer do the panels. But the role plays that I do are based on personal experience. So, you know, I have experienced hypomania, and I have experienced suicidal depression and suicidal ideation. And so those are the two types of scenarios that I enact with the police.
Is there a number, a website, listeners can find out more information, or if they need help, where can they go to?
There's a bunch of resources. Okay. You know, we at NAMI, we say we're the clearinghouse, right? Where we cut through the red tape. So if people want to call us, they can call 312-563-0445. They can also access us through 311 services, and they can go to our website at namichicago.org. We would love to engage more people with lived experience in the CIT program. It is one of the most popular parts of the 40 hours. And so if more people are interested, there's opportunities to get involved through our website.
How did you guys find each other?
I wanted to say, even before you asked the question, that another way, so the way that I first became involved with NAMI, and another way for people with lived experience to become engaged with NAMI, which I think is fantastic, I first hooked up with them with their high school outreach program called Ending the Silence. I had been working in a school tutoring math. And I, you know, was getting to know my students well, and they were sharing more and more personal stories. And I really, by the end of that year, I wanted to be talking to them about their lives, not math. So when I left that job, I actually spoke with my social worker, and she knew about NAMI and that they had this program. So what Ending the Silence is that folks with lived experience can go to various high schools around, public high schools around Chicago, and speak with a health or science class. There were one or two occasions it was like an assembly, and just tell their life story for the sake of, you know, getting that conversation started sooner for young people, which I think is amazing. So that's how I got started. And then my boss from Ending the Silence found out that I do improv comedy, and she thought, well, hey, maybe you should try the role play thing, and that's how that happened.
We're going to take a break for David Jennings in the news here in a minute. Yeah, I'm going to ask you to stay for a little bit longer, like maybe to 9:45. I mean, that's the thing is, I mean, you guys know now I'm kind of reluctant to do radio, but something like this is really important to me, to be able to bring this up and talk about this. We did it with Carl with Sip of Hope, and I think we're doing a service to some people who might be listening. So I don't want to run through this. So you got to hang around after the news?
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. We'll continue with this after the news with David Jennings on WGN.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN, and we're talking about mental health in the Chicago Police Department, the Chicago Fire Department. We're going to get into 911. I wanted to play the five stair steps there because the late Clarence Senior Burke was a Chicago police detective, and he was the family leader of that band.
Hmm. Learn something.
It's great,
new.
And it's such a great song. We're talking about community and understanding. Yeah. That's what that song is all about. David Jennings, did you have a question?
Yeah, and bear with me. With the military, we have had for a very long time this inability to figure out that when people come back, that you don't just pull the plug, that you don't just walk back into daily life. Do we have to now get more serious about the conversation that people who put on the uniform and a star, they, and not just the public dealing with that, but also members of the department understanding that, you know what, we have to talk, and you don't have to be afraid to talk. How do you get through to people to get them to be willing to talk?
Did you hear that?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right. We know that there's a lot of stigma surrounding mental health conditions, and it's a really good time to ask that question. One of the reasons why we engage with brave souls with lived experience to share their stories is because research tells us that you can't demonize somebody you know, and that the best way to reduce stigma is to hearing from other people's perspectives, which is why at NAMI Chicago and at other organizations, people's voice with lived experience should be really leading the ship and should be beginning the conversation. It's really when you see people shift, right? Because they see people like Frederick and they see, yeah, this is a lot of work, but he's recovered. He's recovering and he's engaging in the world and he's okay and I'm okay to ask for help too, and it's a safe thing to do. We also teach people what it will look like sometimes when you come out about your mental illness, right? Because not everybody gives you a warm reception. Mm-hmm. And so what we ask people all the time at NAMI to do and in our community is hold on to hope, find a safe support system, find a community in which it is okay to talk about this, and hopefully we will meet you where you are. The issue, of course, is that there's a lot of mistrust in the mental health system, and a lot of people have tried and engaged, and it has not met them where they needed to be. So we're just asking people, try again. Help is out there. People do recover, but it does require work and engagement.
And I just want to say that, you know, I think with so many conditions, but especially something like PTSD, I think there is a lot of disbelief, and I, you know, that is stigma. I mean, the stigma that something is not real, not only held by other people, but sometimes by us ourselves. And something that I can't sing the praises enough of is support groups and group therapy. You know, in these last 3 years that I've been doing well, really been an open book with people, and that's led to a lot of great conversations. But I can't tell you how many, you know, friends and you know, new acquaintances I've met who have been struggling with something, and they're like, but I'm in therapy, you know, I'm trying, and I'm like, that's great, therapy's great, but just speaking with other people who have a similar experience, who simply by their presence and their acknowledgement will validate what's going on in your life, it is so, so valuable. So I think for something like military, like first responders, things like trauma, you know, support groups are vital.
Yeah, that peer-to-peer, right? Especially in military and organizations like that. It's really also important for it to be normalized upon engaging in that organization from leadership, that this is going to happen, that help is available, that you're not weak to ask for help, and that we need to make sure that there's people around you with the same type of experience that you can have some kinship with as you're going through this journey.
If you were allowed to lay out a plan, what else would you add to it aside from getting that door open to people having a willingness to go into therapy? What other things would you want to bring in?
How much time do we have?
Okay, I mean, too much.
Well, no. I mean, if we're talking about first responders or military, there's templates, right, that we're thinking about now that we're building that a lot of other people are. It really starts with the culture. It really starts with acceptance that this is okay and that leadership encourages this, and that if you do ask for help, there's no punitive action. There has to be understanding about trauma in the brain, so people really understand that this changes the shape of our DNA. This changes the way that we see the world, and creating an environment, a work environment that's healthy, where you're not living in constant chaos and stress all the time, right? So there's a lot that goes into it. This isn't just about, as Frederick said, this isn't just about finding a therapist. This is about creating a well community and a well organization, and it's a lot of work.
What happens? So someone says, I need help. Can you just talk about the steps they'd go through?
Well, I just wanted to maybe bridge between, you know, the last question and your question. You know, it's also, and this may be opening a huge can of worms, but it's also a question of, you know, before we can address somebody's trauma, we need to make sure that that person's physical needs are taken care of. We need to make sure they have proper housing. And those things cannot be contingent upon their mental well-being and stability, you know, in the first place. So the housing, the physical needs, the financial needs need to be stable and provided for, I think, in order for us to even tackle the mental health in the first place. And that's why when I was speaking earlier about the wraparound care that was so vital to me, it was because without all of those things being in place and being sort of taken care of and sort of you know, orchestrated by like one person, like a social worker, I would have just drowned, right? And for us not to be, you know, keeping those things orchestrated for the people coming back from war, for people, you know, first responders, is just a gross failure.
So I hear you saying it's kind of a holistic approach, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if I'm worried about where, you know, how I'm going to pay for my home, if I'm worried about my physical health, am I going to worry about where I'm getting my psych meds? Am I going to worry about going to group? You know, no. I mean, I'm not.
Yeah. How many police officers are there in the force? I have a number here of 13,000.
That's a good number.
Because now this is I'm a novice to all this. I'm learning a lot tonight. This a 2017 U.S. Department of Justice report found that CBD's employee assistant program had 3 counselors providing services to more than 13,000 officers. Now, what is that accurate?
They're growing. Yeah. There,
but that's amazing.
But it's 3? Not unusual.
Yeah,
it's not
really,
unusual
it's not.
Other departments, no. It's really, we've been exploring the country, looking at officer wellness programs, and it wasn't that they didn't want it. It's not that the head of the AP was like, this is sufficient.
Uh-huh.
This just, you know, this is a change. This is a culture change, right? That organizations have to be responsible for the physical and mental wellness,
sure,
of their employees.
Wow.
So it is growing. There's a lot of attention right now being paid to the growth of a wellness unit and the EAP within the department. And it's exciting to see that.
I'd also just like to speak that there's a lot beyond just coming in to see a clinician. There's a lot they've been building out. There's a speaker series that they are now holding the second event where they bring in someone to talk about these issues with officers. There's a peer support program. So there's a lot that exceeds just being able to go into counseling that our department is absolutely committed to doing.
And actually, just in the last week or so, CPD released a video about EAP and had a number of officers talking about their own struggles with secondary trauma and talking about getting help, which I thought was amazing, and everybody I think should take a look at it. The Tribune actually had the article and a link to the video. So.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Okay, yeah.
And then you've branched off, talk about, we've been teasing with this, going with the Chicago Fire Department and 911s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so talk about what you do there.
Sure. Several years ago, we all came together as a group, all the first responder agencies, and we include 911 OAMC in that as well, as well as many providers and advocates in the city, and thought, you know, we really all need to be speaking the same language and having the same narrative around this and understanding each other's policies. And the first step with that was, of course, training 911 call takers. So we're grateful to the leadership of OAMC that they invited us in to participate. So every single police dispatch or call taker and dispatcher is now trained in how to identify better mental mental health calls, and we have seen a significant increase in how they are pre-identifying that call, right? So now an officer has much more information walking into a situation. And then through the leadership of Lieutenant Ursetti and Dr. Merkel, who's one of the EMS regional court directors, and some other folks, we've put together an interagency training where fire, police, CIT officers, medical-based staff, and OAMC, both fire and police dispatchers, are training together with role plays, with scenarios, and it's really exciting. They love it, and they're really, for the first time, kind of having a dialogue with each other about what does it look like when we're both co-responding to somebody in crisis.
We're going to take a break. I'm going to keep you till 10 o'clock. Is that all right? If you have to go, go. But I'll keep you the other two. You know, I'd like to do the rest of the hour on this. So, okay. All right. Don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Well, the Rolling Stones wrote a song for me. It's a minor song in a major key.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. And, Alexa James from NAMI, talk about the event you've got coming up at the end of the month. Light the darkness.
Light the darkness. We're super excited. It's our annual gala where we raise money, but more importantly, celebrate individuals who've made significant impact in the mental health community. Lieutenant Ursetti was our CIT Officer of the Year last year. And we really do. We just come together and celebrate. I mean, here's the thing. The narrative around mental illness is typically told in a very somber, hopeless way. And we want to spend the night changing that narrative and talking about hope and recovery and opportunity and real issues and real work that we have to do. So this year we're honoring Commissioner Julie Morita, who is resigning from the head of the Chicago Department of Public Health. She's been incredibly instrumental in talking about behavioral health. Chief Rainey from University of Chicago, OAMC, as we just mentioned. Chicago Survivors, they're a group that respond to all homicides in Chicago and support individuals who've experienced high rates of trauma, and Quinn Rollins, who now just transitioned to J.B. Pritzker's team but does a lot with justice reform.
This is Thursday, April 25th?
It is. It's at the Garrity in Pilsen.
2520 South Hoyne.
Yes, we still have a few tickets available, but we are almost totally sold out.
And how can people learn more about this?
If you go to our website at namichicago.org, all the details are there.
Lieutenant, I have your title as Commanding Officer of the Crisis Intervention Team and Crisis Intervention Unit.
Yes, like Alexa mentioned when she was discussing, the training is at the heart of a CIT program, but it exceeds, again, just training officers, because we really need to coordinate and collaborate with the systems that are involved, like receiving facilities for us here. That looks like hospitals a lot of times, where we bring someone when they're in crisis. There's new triage centers that are in the city on the west side and on the south side. And again, we also are looking at building out our team so that we can better understand the data and the trends that are happening and work on enhancing a strategy that ultimately appropriately responds to people in crisis beyond when they're just calling 911, or if someone's calling 911 because it looks like someone's in an emergency.
And when was the Crisis Intervention Team, when was that formed?
Well, our training in the program started again in 2004.
2004?
Yes.
And how did you find that, or how did they find you? How did you get that role?
Good luck. You know, again, honestly, though, I've had an inclination towards this kind of work. In 2007, I became licensed as a professional counselor in the state of Illinois. Again, I took the training myself in 2006 and found it extraordinarily invaluable for my career and the kind of work I was doing. And when the opportunity came along, again, I had just been promoted a little bit before this opportunity arose. And with my background and my passion for it, I'm very pleased that there was the opportunity to do this work.
For everybody, are there common, and maybe there isn't, I don't know, are there common questions, are there common issues, or is it just as complicated as the world? I mean, what are some of the issues you hear?
During the training week?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, I think the advantage is that we have a lot of veteran officers that are coming in, so they've got a lot of experience that they can match to what they're learning throughout the instruction. We have a lot of subject matter experts, so sometimes they just want to understand things a little bit more. I do think that the highlight of the week is the Family and Persons with Lived Experience panel on Tuesday, where officers really do get a chance to ask questions about how what worked and what would have been different that could have worked for a person who was in crisis when police responded. So, Frederick, did you want to share anything about when you were on the panel?
Yeah, no, I think that's right about what people ask about the panels. You know, I think one thing that happens with the role plays, you know, I think one of the most common things that happens in the role plays, you know, is that you know the impulse when officers come in the room, and I think this is what a large part of the training is to sort of. Not correct this impulse, but change the impulse. The impulse is: you come in the room, you see somebody who's having either the worst day of their life, the most confusing day of their life, depending on the diagnosis, and the impulse is to see that and to say, "Okay, we need to take you to the hospital," right? And that is the end goal. But if you just walk in the room and say, "We need to take you to the hospital," you're missing a couple of things. First of all, from a legal perspective. You won't by that point have actually gotten enough information to write an involuntary hospitalization petition. But more importantly, I think, you know, as Alexa was speaking to before, you want to build that rapport, right? You want to assess and say, you know, what's happened today to get you to this place? You know, have you been sleeping? Have you been eating? What have the last couple of days of your life been like? And not only is that going to, you know, garner the information you need to give to hospital intake when you get there, but it's also going to, you know, make the person feel like a person again because they're feeling really out of control. So I think what happens really beautifully, you know, by the end of the CIT training is this weaving together of, yes, the legal, yes, the psychiatric information that these officers gain from that, but also it does weave together with simply humanizing the person who's going through a crisis.
I think that what we hear is that officers are confused, mm-hmm. right? Like, why? I think that they're eager to be there and eager to be helpful and eager to keep people safe. I think they're like, why are we here? Like, why is this our problem, right? Why has the system failed this community so deeply that people are getting so sick to the point that they need our intervention? Mm. We have to remember that we should not get comfortable with this conversation, that there is no other chronic medical condition where we utilize the police and taking people against their will in many instances to mandate treatment, right? That we have such a broken system that people get to the point where they need a crisis or a police, right, response. So I think a lot of their questions are really interesting about the system. How did we get here? Is this about, you know, this closing or this budget impasse? Why don't people take their meds? Uh-huh. You know, why do I continue to see the same person over and over again? And it's great because, I mean, it's not a good story, but that's when we can dive into a conversation with the officers about the system, about housing instability. We say, how many people who you see over and over again that you continue to take to the emergency department have unstable housing, and they all raise their hands, right? So uh-huh. we start to frame for them that housing is healthcare, that mental health care uh-huh. should be primary healthcare. And this is a real big opportunity for all of us to have a different conversation. And when they get there, then they're even more eager to participate in this system change. And for them, it's showing up on the worst day of someone's life and doing the best work they can do.
You know, what's fascinating for me on this is all new. This is all an hour of discovery for me. I mean, it is all new in what you guys do. I mean, you mentioned Memphis. Are there other cities you look at that are doing models like this? Talk about that.
A lot of people do CIT, the 40 hours, which yeah. is, you know, there's fidelity. A lot of people have decided to do different types of training programs where they start, for example, in the recruits in the academy, and they continue to engage with the officers throughout their professional development, as opposed to just like one block of 40 hours. We're adjusting to that too under Lieutenant City's leadership and the leadership of the training academy and the Bureau of Patrol, where now we're going to have refresher trainings and advanced trainings again and things like that. But every department, you know, this is not cookie cutter. We have to look at the city. We have to look at the budget. We have to look at what the community needs and the level of engagement of support and the providers. And really, at the end of the day, this is about making sure that officers have this as a skill set, because unfortunately, the reality of their work now is that they're very frequently the mental health safety net.
It's tough in Chicago right now.
Well, and I also just want to say that it exceeds the 40-hour training. Our recruits get modules on mental health awareness. The department has an excellent cadre of officers that are instructing in service over the course of 2 days, where they teach about mental health signs and symptoms and how to respond. So as Alexa mentioned at the beginning, this is considered a program for officers who want to sign up for this, want to become knowledgeable in this specialized area. But outside of that, the department is very dedicated to making sure that it's from the recruit through other areas of in-service training.
We talked about nine. We only got a couple minutes left. We talked about 911. Talk about branching off into the fire department.
So right now we're just doing the interagency training, so the training with all of them. However, in I think next month we are going to start training fire dispatchers, which will be great. So there'll be some standardization between what the police are receiving and understanding and what the fire department is too. So they're really all hands on deck in trying to figure out how to best support the community through 911, but also how are we supporting the 911 call takers, right? I mean, they also have a really incredible gig where they're hearing screams that are haunting and getting on right to the next call too. So we have to keep them in mind when we're talking about wellness.
Share the information again. Websites, phone numbers where people can call, resource information.
Is this when I give Lieutenant or City's personal cell phone out? Or Frederick? The NAMI helpline is 312-563-0445 or 833-NAMI-SHY. And our website is namichicago.org.
And talk about your event again one more time.
It's April 25th at the Garrity. It's called Light the Darkness. Come and join us in celebration of mental wellness.
Did I miss anything in an hour?
That was very thorough. I'm very excited.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much, you guys, for coming in. It's just fascinating what you're doing. It's so important what you're doing. You know, how did you get involved in this?
By accident.
Yeah. I've asked everybody else. I know the backstory is the other two.
Very
real quick,
interesting story, but I won't share it publicly. But I'm here, and I'm a social worker, and I landed at NAMI, and fortunately for me, I fell in love with the organization and never want to leave.
Okay, so thank you, Lieutenant Antoinette Ursetti of the Chicago Police Department, Frederick Nitsch, role player, and Alexa James, executive director of NAMI, and we'll be back after David Jennings the news with Project Onward on WGN.